supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dozens of protesters have been camped outside the ICE office along 8th and Cherry Streets in Philadelphia since last night. Today, police attempted to clear protesters from the site, as WHYY's Sarah Hoover reports.
Philadelphia police wanted clear access to ICE headquarters by Tuesday afternoon and arrested 29 out of approximately 75 protesters who were blocking the building's main entrance. Those detained were issued citations, then released. The protest began on Monday with a rally at City Hall, followed by a march to the ICE office and then an overnight encampment. Protesters blocked entrances and garage doors to the building. Many sat on blankets and under beach umbrellas in the 90-degree heat with coolers full of water nearby. Signs read, "No one is illegal, no borders, and Sanctuary City." They chanted, "Abolish ICE," and some passing cars honked. Protest organizer Marlon McAllister says they're there to take up space and show people are united around the issues of immigration.
We're sort of choosing this spot because it's in front of the sort of garages that are used to transport detainees. And so we're effectively trying to shut down the facility for as long as we can.
Their demands are to abolish ICE, close Pennsylvania's Berks County Residential Center that jails migrant families, and end Philadelphia's data sharing contract with ICE. Rachel, who lives in West Philadelphia, had been there for 15 hours.
We can't go on as we have been doing. Like, we can't accept just letting these kinds of complete, like, flagrant disregard for, like, humanity and human rights go unchallenged. We need to meet it with the response that it merits.
The protest against ICE in Philadelphia is part of a wave of protests nationwide against the Trump administration's plan to detain immigrant families indefinitely while their immigration cases are being processed. For WHYY News, Sarah Hoover.
At this hour, efforts continue to contain the some 15 million gallons of water that poured into Center City Philadelphia streets due to a water break. Joining me with a look ahead is Howard Newkrug, professor of practice at Penn and director of the Water Center at the University of Pennsylvania, also former commissioner and CEO of Philadelphia Water. Howard, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
I'm happy to be here.
There's never a good time for this to happen, and here we are on the cusp of the holiday weekend. Are you surprised that an accident of this magnitude took place?
We have had a number of breaks of this magnitude in the past decade, and it will happen again. This is common throughout the Northeast and Midwest, which has a lot of infrastructure very similar to what we have here in Philadelphia. It's something that you see on a recurring basis. We have in the Philadelphia area about 600 to 700 breaks in a common year, and they can go up to 900 to 1,000 with a very cold year.
What is done in terms of regular maintenance in terms of trying to anticipate problem areas?
Every part of a water system is evaluated on a, in Philadelphia's case, a three-year cycle. In other cities, you look at different cycles, shorter or longer.
Is 15 million gallons a lot of water to be lost?
15 million gallons is certainly a lot of water, but putting it into context, beyond lost water and the cost of the water itself, is, of course, life and property, and making sure that no significant damage has happened there. And larger still is just the whole concern about your water system as a whole. Have you created any kind of issues with water quality associated with this? Or is the break such that you'll have to leave a city or a portion of a city without water for any significant amount of time? In this case, the answer is no. They got the shut, as it's called, in 3 hours, and water service is likely restored in most locations.
Is there a potential correlation between the quantity of significant water breaks in a system and the quality of that system's water?
There's a relationship between the quantity, the number of breaks, and obviously the quality of the pipe. In terms of the quality of the water, you're always concerned every time you have a water main break or anything that happens within a water system that you get out there, you get the shut as quickly as possible, and you go and you do some testing of the water and make sure that everything is safe. Typically, it is. The issue is that as these water pipes age, they'll break more frequently. Right now, we have one break every 2 minutes that occur in the U.S., and this number is only going to increase as time goes by, and we don't do enough to replace the water infrastructure.
Do you have a sense of how many miles as an aggregate comprises the city of Philadelphia's system?
Yes, the system of Philadelphia has 3,200 miles of water pipe to replace the 400 miles of transmission pipe, similar to what broke today, last night. The pipe would be about $3 million per mile for a cost of about $1.2 billion. And for the remaining 2,800 miles of distribution pipe, at $1.5 million a mile, that would be $4.2 billion. So a total system replacement cost today would be $5.5 billion.
You cited the northeast part of the country. Is it more the weather that's a determinant, or is it the technology and the composition of the pipes that's now evolved? So if, for example, a new system was made today, it would be more durable than the ones we're talking about.
Interestingly enough, the pipe that was laid in the 1880s, 1890s, it was extremely durable. It has lasted 150 years, and a lot of it is still under the ground and still working fine. Some of the pipe that was put in place in the 1950s, however, was of lesser quality. And what we're finding is that in 2018, you're replacing pipes that broke in 1950, another pipe that's broken in 1880. So there is no direct correlation between age, but it is quality of pipe, quality of the construction of the design, and how well it was laid, and the contractor, him or herself.
Professor Newkrug, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Sure, thank you.
Howard Newkrug, professor of practice at Penn and director of the Water Center at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also served as former commissioner and CEO of Philadelphia Water. After a decade of dormancy, the former General Motors vehicle assembly plant near Newport, Delaware, is about to get a multi-million-dollar overhaul. As WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports, backers hope that after some false starts, this plant will generate 2,000 jobs.
Since opening in 1947, the GM plant on Boxwood Road employed thousands of Delawareans. As many as 1,200 cars a day once rolled off the assembly line. Cars like the Chevrolet Chevette, the Pontiac Tempest, and eventually the Saturn Sky were among hundreds of thousands of vehicles that hit the road after being built in Delaware. But all that work stopped on July 28, 2009. This silver Pontiac Solstice was the final car to roll off the Wilmington assembly plant as GM closed the plant amid the company's bankruptcy. Workers signed their names on the car that marked the end of an era.
All right, let's see you shut her down.
She's history. Last car.
Stan Kaminsky worked at the plant for more than 30 years installing seats and other interior components.
It was a real hit. Plus, I lost my job. And to see a lot of my coworkers lose theirs or have to transfer to other GM facilities.
There was a glimmer of hope in late 2009 as electric car maker Fisker made plans to move in to take GM's spot. Then Vice President Joe Biden stoked those hopes during a rally, a grand celebration of what seemed to be a last-minute reprieve for hundreds of workers.
Imagine with me, imagine the day when 2,000 workers are once again passing through those gates.
But the workers didn't come. Despite the hype, Fisker never produced a car at the plant. Even with more than $500 million in loans from the U.S. Department of Energy, Fisker's plans to produce 75,000 to 100,000 cars per year fizzled. Today, the plant is much as it was in 2009. The massive buildings sit dark and empty. There's only the hum of a few overhead lights. But all that's about to change. Local developer Tom Hanna has big plans for the future of this massive property. As president of developer Harvey Hanna and Associates, bringing jobs back to the site is not just a professional goal for Hanna, it's personal too.
To me, it's sentimental. My uncle, my grandfather, my father all worked in this plant. there's a piece here that's just really a part of us that is just almost overwhelmed with the idea that, you know, so many families in our area, you know, had their livelihood supported, you know, by this plant.
Hannah's company purchased the Boxwood Road site in October 2017, but isn't saying how much he paid for it. The company now plans to tear down the existing 3.2 million square foot structures and build four or five modern buildings to house new employers.
We spent many months trying to find corporate clients that could find reuse value in the existing buildings. That proved to be futile. The trend with industrial real estate these days is more in logistics and fulfillment, and that's what the market has indicated is the highest and best use here.
For logistics and fulfillment, think businesses like Amazon, shipping products around the East Coast and beyond.
Based on our research, we estimate around 2,100 new jobs will be created here at the Boxwood property.
A feel for where things...
Hannah presented the plans to the community at a recent town hall meeting. Debbie McQuilkin and other residents mainly had questions about the noise trucks and trains would make moving product in and out of the site if it becomes home to a massive warehouse operation.
I just had concerns about the noise. I mean, I'm all for this going through. I'm all for the Boxwood plant to be refurbished, bring jobs, bring a hope, I guess, for this area.
There were a few questions about environmental contamination at the site after its 40 years of use in manufacturing. A plan of action to remedy two contaminated sections is still being developed. Environmentally, 72% of the site is ready for redevelopment. The plans have support from local elected leaders like Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer.
From day one, since I came into office 18 months ago, we've been working very closely with the new owners of Boxwood, Harvey Hanna. And they have filed an exploratory plan. That plan is going forward.
State Senator Anthony Del Colo represents the area around the plant. He says after the disappointment of GM's closing and Fisker's failed rescue plan, the site's rebirth would be a welcome sight.
I think it would be a story of hope, a story of what a community that works together can achieve.
And while there's optimism that a rebirth of the site will bring jobs and economic growth, it will be bittersweet for former GM workers like Stan Kaminsky.
I never was in the Chrysler plant, but when I drive by there after they tore it down, that hurt. And so I know this one's going to hurt too.
Hannah expects a construction plan to be submitted sometime in July, with demolition starting sometime before the end of the year.
It could be a great ending to a turbulent time in the economy. This could be a great ending.
And all this work only pays off if tenants agree to move in. And so far, Hannah hasn't announced any companies signing up to move in. From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
The Allentown Cadets are one of the most prestigious and long-standing drum and bugle corps in the United States. We're listening to their performance from Saturday night in Allentown, the first home show of the season. But there were a lot of doubts about whether the group of 154 young people between the ages of 16 and 22 would even have a season this year. George Hopkins led the cadets for 34 years. He resigned in the spring after women accused him of sexual harassment and assault. He denies all allegations. Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Tricia Nadolny broke the story and has been reporting on the fallout ever since. WHYY's Nina Feldman went with Tricia to Saturday night's performance to see how this tight-knit community is trying to reconcile its past with a new leader and embrace the women who came forward.
We woke up and we had something to eat, you know. And we just felt so sick to our stomach. And we had empanadas. And we're just like, God, that's making us sick. And you know, it's just like, no, that's not making us sick. It's the agita. It's the agita. Yeah. You know, this is our
angst. So we just heard from twins Linda and Leanne Riley, two former cadets who spoke out against George Hopkins. And here with me in the studio is Tricia Nadolny from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Hi, Tricia.
Hi, Nina.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the twins?
Sure. The twins started twirling batons when they were 6 or 7 years old. They've always done this. They were 17 when they auditioned and finally made the cut. And it was during that first summer, actually, that Leanne says that George Hopkins, who was then the cadet's assistant director, took her to a hotel, basically, and had sex with her without her consent. It was actually 2 years later then when Linda says that George approached her in a practice room. And she didn't say no, but she also didn't say yes. She didn't really know that she could say no at that time. So Linda and Leanne are two of the now 11 women who have come forward with allegations against George Hopkins.
So why were they so nervous?
For decades, they had been terrified of coming forward if they told their stories. And that anxiety, I think, doesn't go away overnight. We met them actually at a picnic for alumni in Allentown before the show. It was at a park near the stadium. And they said that they circled that park a couple of times before they decided to get out of the car and go say hello to everyone.
Can I get my hat? And my glasses? Can I get my
you
hat?
You can't hide yourself. We're the twins.
Leanne, go in one entrance. I'll go in the other.
I love you.
This article, when it came out, sowed a ton of chaos for the organization. George resigned, but also the 10-member board of directors within a couple of days of the article coming out. And George is obviously just one guy, but he had his hands in every part of this organization. So his departure just created a huge void.
When we were there on Saturday night, I was really struck by the scale of this organization. I had no idea it was so large. So I was hoping that for people who might not have ever even heard of Drum Corps, you could kind of describe this world.
Each corps has 154 members, and those members come from all over the country and sometimes even internationally to be a part of the best corps. They have an 8-week tour where they're competing against other corps, and it culminates with a national championship. So think members, staff, volunteers, their props for their shows, their uniforms. It really is massive.
It's like a movie set back here.
You know, that's the food truck. So they do all the cooking on that thing, which is like crazy to think about.
Right, and it's not like a food truck. It's like
a semi.
So the cadets have actually been doing this for longer than just about any other corps. They were founded in 1934, and they've won 10 national championships. They were in Barack Obama's second inaugural parade. And George, as the face of the cadets, was really a fixture in this activity for four decades.
And who did they get to replace him?
So they've named Scott Litzenberg as the new director. And interestingly, he is a former cadet himself, and he actually marched with three of Hopkins' accusers, including the twins.
In a lot of ways, that's our family. I mean, once you're part of this group, you are always a part of it. And to see people in our family that are affected that way has been very difficult.
Scott is really doing his best to shield the cadets from the chaos that's going on in the organization right now.
They're very highly motivated to be one of the best corps this corps has ever had, because they know it's on their shoulders to keep that going right now. And that's a lot for kids.
It seems to me that one of the biggest reasons that this scandal touched this community so deeply is that the whole appeal of Drum Corps is this importance that's placed on ritual and tradition. They have this beautiful a cappella hymn that they sing before every performance.
My holy name.
And all the alumni stay in touch over the years. They volunteer. Their kids do Drum Corps. So how did it seem like people were dealing with this scandal becoming a part of that history?
Yeah, it was really devastating for people. People wondered, how did I miss this? How was I not here to support them? But on Saturday, you know, again and again, I heard from people that they felt like George Hopkins' departure really felt like a weight being lifted off of the cadets, like a chance for the cadets to get better and forge a new identity without him at the forefront. You know, he really led with a tight fist. He was front and center in everything and had control over every aspect of this organization. And many alumni really said that he made them feel unwelcome. He made them feel unwelcome within a community that they considered their own family.
For holy name shall always be.
I would imagine that the people who have the most heightened sense of what it means to be a cadet with and now without George Hopkins are the current Corps members.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I talked with the current drum major, Claire Albrecht, who's now in her third year marching and who was pretty close with George Hopkins, about how she's handling this change.
I will say that George taught us a lot, and something that, you know, we've been told is, like, it's okay to still believe in some of those things. And you know, the biggest thing that we've said is that, you know, this Drum Corps is not and never was just one person.
It seems like what Claire is dealing with here is something a lot of people are grappling with in the Me Too era. How or whether to separate the good work that someone has done from really inexcusable actions.
Yeah, I think that's right. Both current and former cadets seem to be trying to reconcile their drum corps experiences under George, which for many were really positive, life-changing experiences, with what these allegations against him are now telling them about George. And that's not an easy thing to do.
Performing their 2018 program, the Unity Project, Drum Corps International is proud to present the cadets.
Okay, so back to the show. What was Saturday night like for the twins?
As they took in the show, they were laughing, they were crying, they were cheering and hugging each other. You know, it was fun because each time the color guard would throw their flags into the air, the sisters would hold their breath and wait for that clean catch.
Sweet, look at that. Seriously?
And then exhale as if they were out there trying to catch those flags themselves. They were really tightly wound in the beginning, and you kind of saw that melt off them as they got more into the day and more people came up and hugged them and told them thank you and told them that they were proud of them.
I did not expect so much love and support. I did not. I was so afraid that there would be naysayers, and that wasn't the case. Not the case at all.
They told me that it felt like coming home.
Trisha, thank you so much for coming in. And thank you also for all your incredible reporting and bringing this issue to light.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Trisha Nadolny speaking with WHYY's Nina Feldman. For more on the cadets, visit WHYY.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.